Good evening, everyone. It's good to be gathered this evening here at Martin Chapel at the Seminary Building. I'm Brian Martin Burkholder, University Campus Pastor and Director of Campus Ministries, and one of several faculty and staff members who have cared for the program this evening. Lisa Shirk led the way along with Carolyn Stauffer, who are both here, if you don't mind raising your hands. Carolyn in the back. Thank you for your leadership, Carolyn and Lisa. And then they quickly pulled in several others to plan for this program, including Kevin Clark, seminary campus pastor and professor of spiritual direction, myself, and Pam Comer, director of our counseling services. And we connected early on through Ross Erb with the Collins Center. And I believe there are several people here this evening from the Collins Center. If you would raise your hands, right, two people at least at this point, and we're glad that you're here. A community resource for prevention and advocacy services around sexual abuse and sexual assault, sexual violence. This evening has also been cared for in the planning, especially in what happens in the hour or so after the program, by our EMU Coalition on Sexual Violence Prevention. Mariah Martin is currently student coordinator. Is there someone coordinating with you this year? On behalf of the Coalition on Sexual Violence Prevention, we thank you. And we'll share more about the expression stations later on. You have a program, a flyer in front of you, and you'll see right there the title, The Spiritual Impact of Sexual Abuse in Religious Contexts. We are hosting Father Thomas Doyle, but I learned earlier today that his strong preference is Tom Doyle. So I will introduce you, Tom, in the simple fashion, and not with the full, as he referred to it, eulogy that was used this morning when he was introduced to faculty and staff. Tom Doyle is a world-renowned Catholic leader, the leading victim advocate within the Catholic Church, the Roman Catholic Church, a priest, canon, lawyer, addictions therapist, and longtime supporter of justice and compassion for clergy sex abuse victims. As we engage together this evening, may we open our hearts, our minds, our souls to learn from mistakes others have made and be truthful about mistakes we've made, individually, as the church, institutionally. Let's open ourselves to transformation, the possibility of transformation and recommitment and moving ahead from this place, from where we are. Tom will open with the presentation, going as long as he wishes and he needs to develop the presentation fully, and then we will have a time for questions, Q&A, and we'll pass a few mics. At that time, we'll ask you to introduce yourself, at least by name, and then ask your question into the mic so that everyone can hear. We are recording this evening video and audio, and those resources will be available for those who could not be here this evening. We would like to thank you, Tom, in advance for being with us, and let's do that as we welcome him to the podium, Tom Doyle.
Thanks for keeping it short. I really appreciate that. I want to say thank you for having me here. I want to thank especially Lisa and Barbara and the others who have made this possible for me to come here. I want to start out with a little personal disclosure. I'm a recovering alcoholic. My name is Tom, and I'm an alcoholic, as we say in the business. I've been sober for 25 years, and my spirituality in many ways, well, and probably almost totally, was discovered, at least I discovered it, in my involvement in 12 Steps and in the life that that has given me again. And so I appeal to that, and I probably will maybe use, as I'm speaking tonight, some AA language, 12-step language, and I hope you understand. The fact that I have been in the nightmare of alcoholism and then managed to find my way out and found that the only way I could stay sober and have a decent life wasn't by taking any kind of medication. It was by developing an honest spirituality. And I had to learn what that meant. So that's my, I want to begin with that. Now, this morning I had the privilege of speaking before, I guess, the university staff and faculty. I was seated at a table next to the president, and it was kind of mind-blowing for me in a sense that I've been involved in this issue of sexual abuse of children and the vulnerable for 32 years, and my own denomination, more often than not, at least the official level, treat me, I've never been invited to speak before a bunch of bishops, let me just tell you that. And I'm not complaining, but I just want to put that in the framework of saying thank you to your community for inviting me to be here. But the most important thing, the most important reason I'm grateful is because I know that in your community there are people who are hurting, seriously hurting, because somehow or other they have been sexually abused, and that there are also others that are hurting and may not even know they're hurting because they're predators, because they're the abusers. And there's a tremendous amount of pain there. And the fact that your community is coming together to try to do something about this says a lot. I want to begin by begging you, which I should have done this morning, but I'm doing it now, begging you to learn from the horrific mistakes other denominations have made, especially the Roman Catholic Church, which has made humongous mistakes with regard to the issue of sexual abuse of the vulnerable in our midst, and they have suffered from it. And in some ways, the suffering is turning into a very gradual, slow rebirth where this institutional monarchy is starting to slowly become and to understand that what it really has to do is not resemble a monarchy, but the body of Christ, which is what we're all about. So please, you know, learn from the mistakes that we have made. Do not try to keep the lid on this issue. At dinner tonight, somebody mentioned something about ripping the top off the Pandora's box. Well, if you don't take the top off, the bottom's going to come out, and you're going to get the reality one way or the other. And it's going to be very unpleasant and very, very damaging and very painful and very scandalous. So you cannot keep the lid on any longer. This is 2016. Over the centuries, and this has been a problem in the church and in the Christian churches since the beginning, it has reared its head periodically and become a public issue, a public problem. And the churches, and mostly the Roman Catholic Church, because that was the only game in town, so to speak, until the Reformation, dealt with it in the only way it could, with legislation to penalize the offenders. But the institutional leadership was in charge. They set the course where this was going to go. In our era, that is not the case. In our era today, no matter what denomination you are in or institution you're part of, when sexual abuse of the vulnerable, of the members, becomes publicly known, they are going to be in charge of the direction that it goes in. That's the case in the Catholic Church. It's the victims and their strength and their courage and their willingness to take these humongous risks that has brought this to the surface. And you can't keep something as horrific as sexual abuse covered up in a Christian denomination and expect to survive. You cannot. One thing that has made a huge difference in the Catholic Church is the fact that the leadership did not listen. They kept trying to cover it up. They believe that we're big, we're powerful. Nobody's going to do this to us. We're going to contain it. I remember an archbishop said to me in 1985 at a reception when I was still on the inside, but this was going on, and he said to me, "Tom, don't get too excited about all this pedophilia stuff. It's a nuisance and it will pass. Nobody's really going to sue the Catholic Church." That was a little over $4 billion ago. There's a lot of zeros in a billion, just in the United States alone. One archdiocese, Los Angeles, has kicked out over $1 billion because they refused to believe that they were the vulnerable ones, and they refused to treat the victims as Christ would have treated them. Biggest mistake. Treat the victims as the enemy. Stiff arm them. Don't reach out to them. Listen to the lawyers who say, don't go near them. Take the risk. We're Christians. Do what you think Christ might do. And, you know, the lawyers in our denomination told the bishops, don't talk to the victims. Look what good it did them. $4 billion ago. So keep the victims number. They are the most important players in the drama. And they have to be treated with compassion, with understanding, and with love. They are not the enemy, and that's the huge mistake that we have made, turning them into marginalizing them, believing that they're out to get us, prioritizing the situation in an upside-down manner. The priority is the church. Church equals system, organization, institution, governmental system. That's not church. And I know for a lot of the younger people here, you probably haven't really begin to, you know, experience church as an institution yet or see it that way. I didn't for years. Church was my parish or a congregation, as you all call them. But church, basically, what I've learned through my work is an institution that has to survive. And it sometimes thinks it has to do unchristian things. Well, once you start being unchristian, the bottom's going to fall out. The bottom is going to fall out. So the victims have to be number one. The survival of the system, the church is the people of God, the community. It's not just an entity, a building, a bunch of chairs, a bunch of leadership, a bunch of titles. It's people, all kinds of people. And I always remember, you know, if you look at Christ's life, the people he hung out with were in many ways the rejects and the losers of society. But they are the ones that he was friendly with. And who were the only people Christ ever got angry with? You know? It wasn't the criminals. It was the church guys, the leadership, because they were being hypocrites. And that has to be kept in mind all the time. So cover up and containment will only make it worse. And you cannot begin to imagine how bad that worse can get until you're in the middle of it. Now, what I'm supposed to speak about tonight basically is the religious and the spiritual damage that happens. And what I'd like to do is speak about it partly from a personal context. I was ordained a Roman Catholic priest in 1970. I believed in every bit of it. My church is hierarchical. There's bishops, popes, and so on. I was in it. I was ambitious, but I believed it. And my whole life was at stake within it. And then as I got involved with this issue, and I became involved because it was assigned to me when I was working in the Vatican Embassy. The Catholic Church is the only church that has a diplomatic corps, like the United States. And they've got 150-some representatives in countries around the world, and I was at the one in Washington, D.C., and when this first case that became public in 84 came in, I had to handle it on the administrative level, just prepare letters for the boss's signature and so on. And I got involved, and it became more complicated, and it became public. And I had the opportunity to meet a couple of the victims, 10-year-old boys, and that changed my life. Then I realized covering this stuff up is insane. When you look into a face of a 10-year-old boy and his parents are there, and it's vacant. It's vacant. And I'm sure many of you have children. And if you have children and they're boys or girls, you remember how bubbly and lively they might have been at the age of 10 or 11, getting in trouble and so on and so forth. But think of that, and think of looking into your child's eyes when there's a blank look there, because the soul in that child has been drained away. And that's what happens. So I got involved in this, and over the years, it had an effect on my own belief system. I had to reevaluate everything I thought I believed. And I ended up starting from square one, basically questioning everything, every dogma, every belief, every aspect of Catholicism and Christianity, to the point of even questioning the existence of God. And fortunately, by then, I was deeply in AA, so we had what we call the higher power. That's how we refer to the Almighty, to the higher power. And we say it's whatever you want it to be. It's however you envision the higher power. So I had to reject the God of Catholicism, the supreme leader who was kind of petty and got angry when people didn't pray to him enough, and he got angry if you had meat on Friday and all this kind of thing. And it was a lot of that was mythology. It was an image of this higher power that others had cooked up, and in many ways cooked up because it helped the system maintain its power and its strength. Years ago, I recall a priest who's now deceased. He was an older guy, and he lived in New Orleans. And he said one night, we were sitting around talking, he said, if I ever decide to leave the priesthood, he said, what I'm going to do is get myself a history of philosophy, a Bible, and the Summa of St. Thomas Aquinas, and a case of scotch, and lock myself up in a hotel for a week and write a new religion. And I'll become a millionaire, because all you got to do is the creative use of guilt. And you think about it, there's a lot of validity to that. There's a lot of validity to that. Now, back on point. Let me first contextualize sexual victimization in churches. And I've dealt with not just Christian denominations, but I've been involved in several other denominations as well. Some Christian, some not Christian. And there's a commonality of the way they treat victims, the way they treat whistleblowers, the way they treat the offenders. There's a commonality, a consistency that you find all the way through. And one of the big areas of that commonality is that the system becomes sacrosanct. The governmental system becomes the church that we have to protect at all costs. Basically, these are religious communities oriented toward the good, toward doing good, toward thinking good, toward hoping good. But the historical framework of the Christian churches, again, beginning with Catholicism, is a framework of patriarchy, hierarchical rule, and lay passivity. Now, a lot of that was objected to when the Reformation came along, because Luther and a lot of others had had enough of that stuff. But it's still around. One thing that I think is built into way too many churches is a stratified society, where you have the leadership that becomes a leadership elite. And in our case, it's an aristocracy. Teachers, pastors, elders, whatever you want to call them, they become, just by dint of the way political systems work, they become an elite. But they have to constantly be called to question, remembered, we are an elite, but for service. One of the titles of the Pope is Servant of the Servants of God. And I've always thought all these humble-sounding titles are waste of breath. Don't even say them, because they're mythology. So you have a stratified society, and in many denominations, a clergy and a laity. Then you have the many roles of the leadership, pastors, elders, priests, rabbis, ministers, teachers, but they're all men and women who have important positions. Then you mix in custom, myth, all of the things that are built up over basically any society as it moves through history, and churches have a lot of that. And myth can be good, myth can be bad. Customs can be good, customs can be bad. I think, to me, the judge is whether they hurt people or not. If they hurt people, they're not good. In the Christian sense, if they don't hurt people and they glorify Christ in the real world, not just by saying, we love you, we love you, we love you, that doesn't do any good unless you do something about it. You have that. Then you have a mixing of religiosity and spirituality, where spirituality oftentimes equals docility, obedience to the system, obedience to the governing structure, obedience or acceptance of the leadership, the teachers, the pastors, the elders, doing what they want, because that's the way God wants it to happen. But that's not spirituality. That's religiosity. That's compliance. It can be good, but it can also be very detrimental. Then there's the belief in the spiritual reality of a higher power that connects and relates to all aspects of the body of Christ, of the people, and not just the leadership and not just the governmental structure. So that one of the things that's gotten me in a lot of trouble over the years is when I publicly said that I don't need a pope or a cardinal or a bishop to communicate with the higher power. I can eliminate the middleman and do it directly. Well, that goes against the grain with some religious denominations who believe you have to do anything like that through the intermediary. So docility, obedience, and being quiet suddenly become religious virtues. And these are commonly confused with authentic spirituality. They're not spirituality. I learned when I got into AA that spirituality isn't an affect. It's not something about me, the way I appear, the way I look, the way I talk. And that's what I thought it was when I was in seminary, when I was a younger priest. But some guys were very spiritual. They looked spiritual. They acted spiritual. And I knew I could never be like that, so I figured I'm never going to be spiritual because I can't be like these guys. And then I learned the hard way that spirituality is a realization of my connection somehow with a spiritual reality out there that you can't see, the higher power. And maybe that manifests itself through my group when I go to my meetings. It's manifesting itself here in some way or other. We're here together. Spirituality is not something that makes me better or worse. It's just there. It doesn't matter how I look or how I dress. That doesn't tell me how to be spiritual. Spirituality doesn't tell me any of that. But it does tell me that I'm connected somehow to a power greater than myself, and it's a good power. And in my kind of goofy theology, that power is God, is love all over the place. And you see it happening in small ways and in big ways. So the institutional structure, unfortunately, becomes identified with the people of God, with the church. The church is a spiritually grounded community of people, but it's a movement through history. It's a way of life in some way or other that different people get involved in it in different ways. There's no one good way to be a church person, a member of a church. I remember one priest said that you can't be a good parishioner unless you're on at least one committee. This was the plague after the Second Vatican Council when we started trying to be democratic in the Catholic Church. Well, you know, that was fine, but all of a sudden you had this bureaucracy that was growing up all over the place. One of the things that has happened that you get involved in is the dependence on external structures, on symbols, and on rituals. and believing that those who are conducting these services, the rituals that wear the robes and so on, are truly intermediaries with the higher power. And we need them to communicate with the higher power. Of course, the reformers didn't kind of buy into that idea too much, but it's still there. It's still present in most of our communities. So what happens when a believer is sexually violated by one whom he or she trusts? And I understand in your context, most of the victims are adult women. So of course, the first thing, well, they're adults, they must be consenting. Not so. That's a myth, an absolute myth. First, there's a power differential. And once you have that power differential, that takes away the whole concept of consent. If there's a seduction process, a grooming process, you cannot say there's any consent. If there's any wish on the other, if the person feels, I don't have much of a choice here, that's sexual abuse, it's sexual violation. If the woman believes she's been violated, thinks she's been violated. And so this baloney that, well, they must be mutually consenting, so therefore it's okay. That has to be eradicated because it's a disservice to the community, but it's a special disservice and a re-victimization of those who've gone through it. First, there's a physical intrusion, the sexual violation itself. There's a psychological and the emotional shock. Then there's the violation of trust by a minister, a priest, a rabbi. Most of the victims in the churches are devout, believing members. All the victims in the Catholic Church that I've ever dealt with the exception of three, were boys or girls from very devout, believing, docile, contributing families. And so the shock value, when they found themselves being violated sexually by a priest, and I've talked to so many victims that said they couldn't even... they didn't know what to find the words to express what happened to them. And that also goes with adult. I've talked to, you know, encountered enough adult women and some adult men who were sexually abused by clergy who preyed on them and used their power and their influence and used the fact that oftentimes these were women or men that were in an unfortunate situation. They were newly divorced or had lost a spouse or lost a child. They were vulnerable. And when you're vulnerable, and we've all been vulnerable, I think, in many ways you're kind of helpless. You can't think straight in a lot of ways. You're looking for support, for assistance, wherever it's going to come from. And it looks good coming from the church guy. He's not going to hurt me. He's not going to harm me. And then pretty soon it happens. And I remember speaking to a young girl, she was an Eskimo girl from Alaska, and she said, I knew what he did to me was wrong, but I didn't know what it was. I couldn't put any words to it. She was 15 years old, and she was raped by a priest. She didn't know, she said, I couldn't verbalize, but I knew it was wrong, and it still hurts me. She was 60 years old at that time. The violation also impacts the trust bond that you have with the higher power, with the one who this is all about, the church is all about. If the leadership, the church men or the church women, do this, what's that say about the higher power? Most of what I've learned about this stuff, I've learned some from personal experience, but also from others. I was at a press conference a few years ago in Delaware. A man who was in his 50s at the time had just finished a trial where he had sued the Diocese of Wilmington, Delaware, because he had been sexually abused repeatedly by a priest, and the jury found in his favor. And there was a press conference afterwards. And one of the members of the press said to him, Mr. So-and-so, do you still believe in God? And I'll never forget the response. He said, how could I believe in a God that would allow his sacred priests to come down and every day rape an 8-year-old boy? And I never forgot that. And I asked myself, That's the question. It's a very profound question. How can you believe? How can a victim believe? How can a young woman from this community believe in this higher power that we're supposed to be all about if this has happened to her? But to make it worse, that's bad enough. But when the system, when the church appears to cover for that individual, to support that individual, to enable that individual, and makes me look like I'm the enemy, what does that do to your sense of belief and your sense of trust and your sense of faith? It just throws it out the window. And for individuals who have been there saying, I want to have nothing to do with this stuff, I can't believe in this nonsense anymore, and walk away, that's the only sane thing they can do. It's the only, because they have to protect themselves, otherwise you stay re-victimized. If you're in a community, and I'm going to use my own denomination, a priest in this one particular parish liked very young teenage boys and girls, and he'd violated a number of them, but nothing ever happened because the bishop, of course, just looked the other way. The bishop had his own problems. So this went on. And pretty soon, it became known, and the community sided with the priest. And I remember talking to three sets of parents who were first horrified, then inflamed with anger, and then they became despondent because this was their connection to the higher power. And they said, we're done with this. We're leaving. We are no longer Catholics. We're no longer Christians. This is all a myth, because if it were true, none of this would have happened. And what they focused on wasn't what the priest did to their children, but what the community and the community leadership did to them. And that's where the damage happens. It begins to happen in that way. So when the institutional response is self-serving, when the community response is fearful, you know, we don't want to blow the whistle on the priest or the bishop or the elder. Why? Because all too often, our spirituality, our religiosity, the reason we're in all of this, is tangled up with the leadership. They tell us what to do. They tell us how to think, how to pray, what's right and what's wrong. And if these guys are blown out of the water, that means I'm on my own. And that's very threatening. It's very fearful. It's very scary. And that's one of the reasons why you see people turning on the victims. Because we've put them in that position. We've put the clergy. We have made people dependent on us in the Catholic Church for everything. We got seven sacraments. That's the way you get to heaven, through the seven sacraments. The clergy control them all. The lay people, you know, it's a passive, dependent relationship. So the spiritual connection with the higher power is either shattered, and then you go through perhaps a lifelong process of trying to pick these pieces up and put them together, or it's broken, and it will never be repaired. Never. And what may happen, that person may rise again, as I did, and develop a spirituality and find some freedom, but it's nowhere near what it was before. Nowhere near what it was before. My concept of a higher power is radically different than what I was raised with. Radically different. I no longer can believe in a God that demands people worship him, that gets angry with some and is pleased with others and all this business. I just can't. Or a God that you have to bribe. Say a zillion prayers and you get your wish. Light a bunch of candles and you'll get your wish. Well, it just doesn't make sense. And I've often wondered, what about those guys, poor people that are in line in hell? They're in hell, okay. They're being processed into hell. And the guy in front of you says, I'm here, I'm a multiple murderer and a rapist. What are you here for? And he says, I'm here for eating chicken soup. Catholic Church, you couldn't have meat on Friday. And we believe that if you ate meat on Friday of any kind, you would go to hell if you died. Life sentence, you know, maximum security, you'd never get out. And that was all the manipulation of the system to to control. So the lost connection, you lose your connection with the higher power through the churches, and there's a fear, there's an emptiness, there's a despondency that kicks in because the place where you used to be able to go for a lot of spiritual needs is no longer there. I remember early on when I really started to realize this, I was speaking with an attorney who helped a lot of the Boston victims back in 2001, 2002. And he said, we've got to do something to get counseling for these victims. And I thought he was talking about psychological counseling. And he said, no, I'm talking about spiritual counseling. And this guy happened to be a devout Jew. Because he said, one of the victims came in to me the other day, and he was despondent, he was crying, he was really upset. And I just listened to him. Why he was there was this. His pet dog had died. His dog had been with him for 14 years. And through all of the years of his pain and anguish from being sexually abused, the dog stuck by him. And that was his friend. And he had developed a bond. Now, I've got a dog, so I know what that's like. The dog died. And so he said he was grieving, and he did what he had been brought up to do. He went into the church just to sit there and pray. But he went into the church where he'd been sexually abused, and he said, I got in there, and it triggered everything. And I thought I was going to have a nervous breakdown right there on the spot. I had to get out of there before I went nuts. He said, now I don't know where to go. I don't know what to do. So that Jewish lawyer was his priest. And for 2 hours, he cried with him. He listened to him. He sympathized with him. And he said, then I got, the lawyer said to me, he said, I figured out through that what we've taken away, what they've taken away from some of these people. And it's true. Oftentimes, our senses of comfort in our churches are with rituals, with persons, with places, with words, with books, that kind of thing. And if you have gone through the betrayal, a lot of that suddenly becomes the opposite it was before. It becomes a trigger to the anger, to the despondency, and the despair. Most of the victims I know are Catholic, and I'd say 99.9% of them cannot go into a Catholic church because they know what happens when they get in there. It kicks a lot of reactions off. And I begin to feel that myself. And I knew that one day I was sitting in O'Hare Airport waiting to change planes, and I saw this priest walking down the corridor there. And he was all dressed up in his black suit and collar and French cuffs and everything else. And I got this feeling of anger inside of me. And it was involuntary. It just happened. And I was talking to a good friend of mine who's a victim and also a counselor. And he said, yeah, he said, you're getting it. You've been around us long enough now. You're starting to feel like we do. And I thought about it. And that's basically what it was. So that's a trigger. Now, if you've been victimized and raped or sexually assaulted, it's worse. One of the things that oftentimes some victims can't figure out is God punishing me. What did I do to deserve this? Especially if the community supports the abuser afterward. And the victim starts to think, I'm wrong. You know, maybe I brought all this on myself. Maybe this, what did I do wrong for this to happen? Now, if you're a Catholic, it's worse. Because for Catholics, anything that's sexual is automatically sinful. And the only way you get away from that is going to confession. And the guy who hears the confession and frees you from the guilt is the one that's been sexually assaulting you. But he's a priest, and priests don't do sins. They don't do sex, and they can't sin. So a lot of victims really believe that this is, you know, they're responsible for whatever this priest has done. And the younger they are, the worse they feel. That's a horrific position to put someone into. So the church, in many ways, It uses its teachings to avoid accountability. The system itself can become the enabler of the abuser. There's two sides of the perversion in some ways, where the abuser, let's say, is urged, confess your sins, seek God's forgiveness, and sin no more. I'm forgiven, I'm free, I can go on my merry way. I don't have to worry about this at all anymore, ever. So that's misuse of one of the key teachings, the concept of forgiveness. Another one is the role of the leader, the priest, the pastor, the teacher, in the church's life. where we glorify that individual and make that individual more important and powerful than they really should be, so they can get a hold on the victim and the victim can be somewhat powerless or a lot powerless to resist and to free him or herself. Then we have the worst thing is when we glorify the structure, the institution, the college, the university. We got to think about our reputation. We've got to think about our stature in the community. And if we let this out, it's going to ruin it. And people will think that we're hypocrites. Well, what are you? You're covering it up, of course. That makes it worse. The biggest thing you can do for yourself is be open and honest and upfront and straight. This happened. We are sorry it happened. A lot of it is our fault. We regret this. We're going to do everything we can not to let it happen again. And when you approach the victims, don't come on with saying, well, I'm sorry for any pain you went through, for any misunderstanding. I've said this a zillion times. If you're the leadership, if you're the president of this university, or if you're the bishop of the local archdiocese, you go to that person and you say, I am deeply sorry for what we did to you. That can solve, at least bring a significant amount of healing to that individual. So you have the concept of forgiveness, which is one of the issues that's really misunderstood and misused. So the victimizer sometimes can feel, well, it's a forgiving church, and so I've gone to confession, or I've acknowledged my sins, I've been prayed over, I've been given absolution, and all is forgiven. The church oftentimes focuses on only the morality of the acts, but sexual violation is a crime. It's a crime in the state of Virginia and in every other state in the union. And that individual is accountable not only to the community, but to the wider community and to the law enforcement agencies. They're accountable to them for the crime they have committed of sexual violation. The community may be urged to forgive the abuser and welcome him back. But that doesn't give any absolution from the accountability to the community at all. That's there, and that's real, and that must happen. Then there's the other side of the coin. There's the victim. And you confuse oftentimes forgiveness with the feeling of forgiveness. You have to forgive. Well, I can't forgive. I can't feel in my heart to forgive this person. Well, then you're still in sin. Well, that's again, re-victimizing the victim. And the concept of forgiveness, it becomes toxic. Toxic is poison. It becomes poisonous to the individual, becomes poisonous to the community. When that victim believes that he or she has to forgive and forget what happened and abandon any hope for justice, any hope for restitution, any hope for accountability, any hope for anything like that. That is perverting the concept of forgiveness. To say, put it behind you, forgive the offender as Jesus forgave his tormentors. Well, unfortunately, I'm not Jesus and neither are you. So the fact is, if you can't forgive that person and you have a feeling of anger and bordering on hatred, that is normal. That's not unusual. And you cannot be talked into your feelings going away. You know, the best that can happen is, you know, if you're working on forgiveness, you work diligently at getting out from under the control that that individual has. As long as you are angry, uncontrollably angry, spewing hatred all the time, which is all understandable, he has control. And so forgiveness, perhaps, is when finally I've arrived at peace. I know what happened to me. I don't approve of it. I'm just trying to wipe it out. I'm trying to move on. Forgiveness happens when the abuser and the complicit church have lost their control over the victim. And as long as that control is there, the victim is still being victimized. As long as we keep telling her or him, You have to forgive. You've got to put it behind you so we can move on and grow. If you do that, you're not moving on and growing. You're moving on and digging the grave deeper that the whole system is going to fall into because it failed to be what Christ wanted it to be. Now, I'm going to wind up and just wind up with a little bit of my own story, I guess, a little bit. I didn't know, as the years went on, I found myself more and more angry with the system, with the bishops, with the Catholic Church. And I felt guilty because some of the anger was because I had been, you know, wasn't listened to, was bounced out, and so on and so forth. And I finally worked through that and realized that was pretty selfish and self-centered. And then my anger was at the system that just didn't get it. You know, all of a sudden, it's not what I thought it was going to be. But I had to work through a lot of that, which I did eventually. And it wasn't easy. But thanks to AA and meetings, I was able to do it. And then I started searching and looking through all that I was supposed to believe. Now, Catholics have a lot more to believe than anybody else. You know, we got a big package. And it was painful to sort through that because it meant I had to delve into so much of my past and things that were so deeply ingrained in me, and now I had to let some of them go. And pretty soon I found I was letting a lot of them go. And a couple things helped me. One was reading the Gospels again and realizing that Jesus didn't have any canon lawyers around him. He didn't have any offices. He didn't have any of that stuff. But he was fairly successful in what he did. So that enabled me, I guess, to move through this institutional tunnel that I was in and move out of it and find an immense amount of freedom because all the stuff that I used to question that made me feel guilty, made me feel wrong, and so on, was no longer there. And in a sense, it was cleaning a lot of things out and helping me to focus on what I should focus on. Now, I'm lucky because a lot of men and women who have been sexually violated by church men or church women never reach that point of freedom. That shadow, that dark cloud stays over them forever. One thing, we have to accept the fact, whether we like it or not, that when you're sexually violated, it doesn't go away. 20 or 30 years on, it's still there. The violation is there, the pain is there. Maybe it's dulled a bit, but it's still there, and your life doesn't, that's part that just simply doesn't heal. It may be deeply off in the background, but it's, for the most part, not everybody, but for most of the people I've encountered, the older people especially, it's there. Now, we as a community can help heal a lot of that when the community begins to embrace these people and they realize that this is church. They do love me. They care. They understand. But what has happened for too many of them has been just the opposite. So this nightmare has profound effects on individuals, on their families, on their loved ones, on the community itself. The stature and the deference accorded to organized churches in our culture has taken a nosedive, primarily and almost exclusively because of the response or non-response to the problem of sexual abuse in its midst. Can be avoided, can be made better. It's going to take a long time, but I think a lot of humility, a lot of honesty, and a lot of risk-taking are what will make the difference. And I wish the best for your community, that you take the risks, that you reach out, chase those victims wherever they are, apologize, love them, be compassionate, be caring. And above all, don't make the mistakes that we have made. You know, don't. Thank you. He told me I'm supposed to take Q&A, which I will.
Yes, and I'm looking for Mike's Mariah and both of you. Before I give mine to you, please stand and give your name and at least just brief context. If you're a community member, if you're a staff, faculty, student here, I think it might be helpful to know who's asking the question.
Sure.
And then your question. And we have until 9, and so we won't feel rushed with this.
I'm Julie Bender. I'm coming from the context of being a Mennonite pastor. And my question is what you would say to institutions, because the victims that I've talked to are the most angry because they got an apology that was from a lawyer and it was all legalese instead of a personal apology. So what would you respond to institutions?
That's not an apology. That's pouring gasoline on the fire. I've seen this where the apologies are contrived, they're orchestrated, they're done by PR firms or something like this. That's not sincere. All that is an attempt to reduce liability. The only solution, the only answer that I can give you to that question is the leadership have to understand that they have to approach the person one-on-one and sincerely, and if you can't be sincere about it, don't do it, but learn to be sincere. That's an apology. And it has to be, it can't be, I'm sorry for the pain you've endured. I'm sorry for what happened to you. Of course you're sorry because it's making you look like a monkey. No, I'm sorry for what we allowed to happen to you. I'm sorry for what we did to you. That's an apology. And the lawyers don't make it. But what the lawyers in our context have done in many instances is they've, as part of the settlement, if it's a legal settlement, they've written in that the victim has to be able to meet face-to-face with the bishop. And what some of them have said, they've told the bishops, now you sit there and you don't open your mouth. And you listen to what this man or woman has to say. And at the end of that, if you can honestly say you're sorry, do it. But if you can't be honest about it, don't. And in some instances, it's been effective. You know, the bishops, they've suddenly been forced to say, they know now they're dealing with a power bigger than they are. And it wakes them up a little bit when they hear this face to face. And many of them said, I never realized how bad this is. Yeah, well, when you're raised in a celibate cocoon, of course you don't realize it. But I think yours is a very good question, and that's the best answer I can give you. But it's not an apology. It's not an apology. And the ones who are running the show with regard to healing should not be your lawyers. It should be the leadership. They're the ministers of Christ, not the lawyers. The lawyers are there to help you. And I understand the law part big time. But I also understand that we have to take the risk of not worrying about being sued and take the risk of reaching out as Christians. And it's a risk rarely taken.
Evan, I'm a seminary student. This is kind of a philosophical question. How is sexualized abuse, sexualized violence, categorically different than any other type of violence? For example, there's a lot of people in this room whose ancestors were murdered by the Catholic hierarchy, burned at the stake as heretics, and so on. So how is, in that context, how might we understand the sexual aspect of this differently than say that?
The best way I can answer that, I understand your question, and I think that the murdering, especially in the name of religion, is probably 28 times more horrendous than in the name of anything else. But I think sexual violence is something that I can only understand to a certain point because I've never experienced it. But those who have and are able to articulate it, it's a violation of probably, I mean, sexuality is one of the most powerful parts of our person, the most misunderstood in many ways, and the most personal. And when you're violated, anywhere from groping your body to full, you know, to rape, you know, it has an effect, I think. And I, as I said, I can't really explain articulately, and I apologize for that. But I do know from what I've seen is that it's a profound violation. It doesn't go away. And unfortunately, the victims in those instances oftentimes are victimized by the system, by others. They're made to feel, well, you must have brought it on yourself. You were raped. A lot of men that I've talked to were afraid and ashamed to admit they were sexually violated as kids because of the shame that, you know, this happened to me. And they couldn't even articulate why they felt so ashamed, but it was because this happened. And this, of course, is the sexual violation. As I said, I apologize for not being able to give you a substantive answer. That's the best I can do. But I can tell you from my experience, talking to a lot of people, men and women, who were violated as younger and as older, the pain, the despondency, all of the stuff that goes along with it is severe.
Hi, my name is Dershio, and I'm a CJP grad student here. I appreciate your talk and how you named how often the understanding of church can become an institution or a structure or the leadership or governmental body, but that spirituality is something beyond that. I'm wondering if you can speak about an alternative conception of church, which isn't that, which is something that can be had by everyday people or congregation or, and even, you know, some kind of body like AA may have been able to constitute or meet some of those same needs that a church congregation would meet for somebody, as in like community, especially with shared values and working towards a shared betterment with a shared framework, you know. I've even heard of some ideas of church happening on the streets or in other areas of life so that everyday people can access it beyond just the boundaries of the institution. So I wonder if you've conceptualized other understandings of church, or I'm not Christian, I haven't read the Bible. I don't know if there's an idea in my religion, Sikhism, we have an idea of like the need for a spiritual community to engage with that. Like that's something that's important for us. So yeah, I was just wondering if you've thought about that.
Let me see if I understand your question correctly. Are there other ways of expressing or living the concept of church other than the traditional?
Other than the institutional aspect of
it. Yeah, that's what I guess that's a better way of putting it, other than the institutional. And I think there are. Whenever you have three or four people together, there's some sense of institutionalization there, even though it's very, very minimal. But remembering the early Christian churches were all house churches, groups of people who met in somebody's home. I've often wondered if AA isn't the closest expression of that today, because AA meets all over, and it's all about people. We don't have priests, rabbis, bishops, any of that. We don't have buildings. We don't have churches. We don't have money. There's a headquarters in New York City, but nobody seems to know much about it. All they do is send out books when you need them. So it's us, and the meetings happen, and we take turns being the leader of the meeting, that kind of thing. And that's an expression. That's one way, I think. Years ago in Latin America, the Catholic Church, when they first began to work through this issue of liberation theology, had what they call comunidades de base. They were base communities, which were small groupings of believers. And they didn't meet in the church. They met in somebody's home. And it was action-oriented. They had the religious, the spiritual dimension, but it was outward-oriented. Now, I guess, you know, those are two expressions, but a lot of it depends on the fundamental religion itself, how that is structured. I've incorporated a number of Buddhist practices into my own, I guess, religious construction, whatever you want to call it. And I did that with the help of another AA member who found that helpful to him. And AA is totally spiritual. I mean, I don't say that bragging, but it's a reality. That's how we operate. And I found these practices very helpful to me. Buddhism doesn't believe, they don't have a God. It's just a way of life. And if you believe in a higher power, that's fine, I guess. That's the best answer I can give. And a lot of it has to do, I think, with what the people who want to have another expression can agree to do. Because you don't have to do what another group is doing. You don't have to do what this denomination or that denomination is doing. You don't have to envision or have an image of the higher power that someone else gave you. It can be yours and your communication. And if you 3 or 4 or 10 people want to get together on an informal basis, that's an expression of what we call church. But we're so used to the institutional thing, I think, that we think, oh, we're really, you know, we're out of whack if we want to do something different. No, you're not. You're actually reaching back to the beginning roots. Did that help? Thank you. I mean, I'm not looking for accolades. I just want to make sure that I'm trying to answer the questions without yakking too much and getting to the heart of the matter.
I'm Sally Leinbach, and I'm a member of the Mennonite community here, just very interested in this subject. And I was wondering, I met a woman one time who grew up Protestant and was attracted to the Catholic Church because of the presence or the importance of Mary in the theology. And I was wondering if the female victims are able to find comfort in Mary, or an ally, or just a comfort there because of that part of your theology, and how, you know, is it different from male victims?
It's a question I can't give you an answer to because I've never encountered a female victim who has brought that up. Generally, almost every victim I've ever spoken with, and especially the ones I've gotten to really know, they don't want to have anything to do with the institution at all. They're searching, they're looking. Some of them are in a dark place looking. Some of them are finding something else. I've met a number of Catholics who've gone to Judaism. They've gone to usually Judaism or the simpler Christian denominations, a real simple, non-adorned, non-liturgical. That seems to be one important factor with a number of them. They don't want a lot of liturgy because it reminds them too much of what Catholicism is. But I honestly have never had the issue of Mary brought up to me. And I really don't know. I can't answer that. I just don't know. I'm sorry. I'm smart, but I'm not that smart.
I'm John Nafziger. I'm a spouse of a faculty member, I guess sort of a quasi-cultural and I guess maybe still quasi-religious Mennonite. I'm not sure if this is going to turn into a question, but a couple of comments and would welcome your response to them. The first is that I think it's important to stress or remember, it's easy if you haven't known anybody in this situation, if you haven't been part of a community where it happens. This is both a spiritual and a legal crime that happens in community and it happens in relationship. I think, as Tom mentioned, you know, these are mostly families who loved their priest, who were deeply involved in their parish. And I was 30 years ago now, when I was in my early 20s, part of a Mennonite church for several years where a well-known, beloved, deeply respected pastor was sexually abusing women in counseling for decades. And so I'm partly here at a personal level trying to process this 30 years later of feeling like, you know, here we are, we've made some movement, but is that just honestly primarily based on legal liability and lawsuits and money and not not our spiritual values and our spiritual activity? And I just, that being said, I appreciate the forum, and I hope that much more conversation will continue to take place before we're responding to another incident.
That's a really good question, statement, whatever. You know, you yourself said you weren't sure what it was, but it's an excellent point. And I think what I heard and what I resonate with is the sense of disappointment, of sadness, of maybe betrayal when someone like that, you find out that that's been beloved, been trusted, been part of the community, there's a dark side. And there's nothing in the books that says how to relate to that. I had to go through it. My first pastor as a priest, I was ordained in 70, I was sent to a parish in the Chicago area. And I really loved this man. He was a good man, he was decent. And I found out many, many years later that he was regularly sexually violating a 13-year-old boy who was in the teen group that I was the leader of. And I felt guilty because my own response wasn't what I thought it should have been, because by then I was deeply embedded with victims. And my response should have been anger at this man, but I couldn't be angry with him. I was disappointed. I was very sad. And I didn't want to get involved with the legal case or anything else. I didn't want to get involved in bringing any more hurt to him. And I knew the kid well, who's now a young man. He's in his 40s. And I was just blown away. I guess I didn't know, you know, it still bothers me, because I was looking for a response that's acceptable, that's organized, that I can put my hand on, and I couldn't. And it left me still. And that's happened a number of times in my own existence, and I'm sure it does in anybody when that happens with somebody that's beloved, that's respected, that's cared about. And this, and that you wonder, my God, you know, how can this be? But it is. But that's a good, I'm glad you brought that up.
My name's Barbara Graber. I'm a community member. I'm a survivor and an advocate, and I'm involved in the local Mennonite chapter of SNAP. A question I get from pastors that I might contact because a survivor has contacted us is, well, how do we take care of... So, for example, a survivor contacts us about an offender that is in this congregation, so I'm contacting the pastor. There seems to be a lot of concern about how is the pastor to care for everyone. I had a pastor tell me, well, we have to care for everyone in the congregation, the offender and the victim. And so I'm wondering if you'd have a response to that. And then I'd also, the second thing I'd love to hear you speak to more is the fear of libel lawsuits. There really seems, when we are urging someone to put out a name that has been reported so that we can invite others to come forward so we can discover the full truth here, there seems to be an incredible fear of libel lawsuit. And those are two questions, if you can...
The first one, I think, I've heard before. Well, we have to take care of everybody. How do we take care of both the victims and the victimizers? I think that's a non-question and a non-answer. The victim is the one who's of paramount importance, I think. The person who's been hurt, the person who was deeply hurting. I was in the Air Force, okay, for 20 years, and I remember there were times when I was expected to celebrate Mass for the congregation when I'd be called away because there was a guy threatening to kill himself. He suddenly became the most important person, and I had to leave my flock, so to speak. And if you're Catholic and you don't get to go to Mass on Sunday, that's a big problem, at least so some believe. So I think in that instance, and taking care of the perpetrator is a whole other issue. And I think if the guy's there, you can't cover for him, and you can't encourage him to remain, in a cocoon somewhere, not coming forward, not admitting what he has done, not accepting the responsibility for what happened. And that all too often is what we do under the excuse of saying, well, I have to be pastor to him too. He has to be forgiven, and I've got to... What that means is I don't want to rock the boat. And I don't want to accept the risk of the chaos that's going to happen when that is surfaced. Your other question was libel lawsuits. Yeah, big problem. Sure. Naming perpetrators? Well, I think that, if you name a perpetrator publicly and it's a confirmed accusation, that happens in the newspapers every day. So-and-so has been accused of this, that, or the other thing, or this one has been convicted of something. If it's confirmed, you may be threatened. People can threaten to sue you for everything from soup to nuts. Doesn't mean it's going to happen, and it doesn't mean you have to pay attention to it. It's a threat. The fact is if someone is accused of this and it is confirmed and there's an investigation going on, there's nothing illegal about publicizing the fact that the investigation is going on and this person is the subject of the investigation. The other issue with the lawsuits, it's a big, big issue in any country where the churches or institutions are having this problem. But the fundamental reason it's an issue is because the churches and the institutions have not done the right thing from the beginning. That's when the lawsuits all started in our denomination, and that's why they spread, is because from the beginning, the victims were stiff-armed. They were lied to, they were manipulated, the phone calls weren't answered, promises were made that were never kept. And just out of sheer frustration, out of despair that this guy is going to keep doing this, the family started going to lawyers, not knowing what there was going to happen on the other end. And so the lawsuits started. The lawsuits are not necessarily part and parcel of this all the time, but it's the first thing that comes to mind with any administrator, any bishop, any church leader. The first thing that comes to mind is we're going to get sued. And I think the first thing, you got to take the risk, the first thing should be, wait a minute, what about the victim? What about the victim? I've often asked victims, when was the first time, how soon after you came out and disclosed you'd been violated, how soon after that did the bishop come knocking on your door? And they all look at me like I'm nuts. What do you mean? Are you kidding? If that had happened consistently, it really makes a huge difference. And if you honestly say, what can we do to help as far as, monetary, paying for counseling, damages, the whole nine yards. I was asked today about best practices. There's a religious order in the United States that does the right thing. What they do when this happens, they reach out to the victim right away, and they negotiate with the victim what the victim thinks they want as far as monetary recompense is concerned. Because in many cases, these people have lost wages, they can't work, they've lost marriages, the whole shebang. And the provincial, who's the equivalent of the bishop, says, whatever they need, they're going to get. If we have to start selling our churches, they're going to get it. And it's working. That's a risk we have to take. Because one way or the other, believe me, if you do it that way, pragmatically speaking, it's going to be less damaging than if you take the risk of... If one major lawsuit here, if you had a victim who really got bounced around significantly, one major lawsuit could shut this university down or deeply, deeply wound it. Because that's what happens when you don't do it right. But as far as being sued, I mean, I've heard, you know, instances, I know of instances where perpetrators have countersued victims for defamation of character, all kinds of things. I don't know of any of them that they've succeeded, but they have. Denial with a sex abuser is pretty stiff stuff. I mean, they stay in denial sometimes and say, I'm going to sue you. You know, this could not have happened. I didn't do it. I wasn't there, yada, yada, yada. Any person who says, wants to come forward and say, I was sexually abused by a clergyman or an elder or something of that nature, and I want to come forward with that, if it really didn't happen to them, they're nuts, because you realize what you're getting into. The instance of false accusations is minimal, and that's something else that's bandied around a lot. Well, what about all the false accusations? Well, what about them? There aren't a lot. There's hardly any. There's hardly any. There have been instances where individuals have tried. They've made the accusation, they've gone to the lawyer thinking they're going to milk the system, but usually most, if not all, of the lawyers I know that represent victims put them through a very stringent screening. And they say, I'm sorry, you know, there's nothing to this. Most of the time, even the defense attorneys will say, most of these are real. They're real. But it's the reaction has to be to try to devalue the victims because they're the enemy.
I'm Elizabeth Wilder, and I'm an undergraduate student here at EMU. And I noticed that we've focused a lot of this evening talking about how theologically, institutionally, or structurally we respond to when these sorts of events occur. So I was wondering if you could speak to prevention methods. For example, my group of friends and I have been talking about this idea that we can't talk about sexual violence if we can't talk about sex in the church. So I was wondering if you could speak to that.
Your question was how to talk about, how to deal with prevention, future issues. I think openness is the first thing. And one of the burdens that Christians have carried has been the concept of sexuality that we've developed. I think it has to be openly discussed, and not with euphemisms or soft focus words. It has to be straight on discussion. You have to be able to do it freely and without worrying. That's one way, and I think a big part of prevention is empowering individuals to know that if you say no or push someone away, you're not going to be penalized, and the community has to make that known to you, has to guarantee your safety, your emotional safety, your psychological and physical safety, that if you do rebuff someone or report someone, that you're not the enemy, you know. And that can be done. It's a change in culture, because the culture is to look at someone who's a sexual victim as if they are some sort of a pariah. But it's a good question. Prevention has to go beyond programs and policies and protocols. It has to be a cultural change, I think. And that can happen if we look at it and deal with it head on and start talking about it, about the fears. Like what you just said is very important. The fear of openly discussing this issue in class, at church, at a meeting. You know, what do we do? I'm a girl on this campus, and I'm getting hit on. And I don't want to have sex with these guys. My girlfriends might. My cousin might. I don't want to. And you got to be able to say that, and people got to support you. Or if you point the finger at somebody. Of course, we all know what happens in some of the big universities. You know, if it's one of the stars, a soccer player, hockey player, football player, and he's the victimizer, and all of a sudden, you know, it's okay. And we have to protect him and protect our image. Well, I'm sorry, but once you start doing that, your image is gone. And the people who really count are going to look at you and say, huh? At least Penn State had enough wherewithal when they had that mess with Sandusky to snap too and not try covering it up, because that would have been 20 times worse. But look at the NFL. Now, I'm sure there's avid football fans here. I remember watching Roger Goodell one morning. I was at the gym working out, and they had the TV set, and there's Roger, and he's talking about, I forget the guy's name, who slapped his wife around and knocked her out in the elevator. And there's Roger sandpapering and talking all around this, and I said to myself, he sounds just like a bishop. He's not saying anything. And all he's worried about is his precious God football. And this poor girl, this brute, knocked her out. And all that's going to happen to him is he's not going to be able to play football for a couple of games. So that's nuts. You know, that's the kind of culture that has to be turned on its head. But I don't have any formula. I mean, that's the best answer I can give you. But it's a cultural thing, more than just rules and regulations.
My name is Amanda Williams. I'm an undergraduate. And I was just curious, like, in response to all of the cases throughout the world, how has the Catholic hierarchy or church specifically addressed, like, priests and helping them to, helping them after they assault a people, and have they ever considered allowing priests to marry?
Your question, what's the Catholic Church doing about the priests that have assaulted people? In many instances, they are abandoning them. They're laicized or they're defrocked and they're gone. In some instances, they offer them therapy, a program of therapy, which is very expensive at specialized institutions. As far as allowing priests to marry, that makes eminent sense. It wouldn't solve the problem, but it would change the culture significantly, and it would deflate a lot of the major virus, which is clericalism. You know, these guys are untouchable. But of course, the present Pope is probably going to think about married priests. It would make sense. I don't know why they haven't had it until now, but, you know, then you get into the whole ecclesiastical politics and power and so on. But basically, the offenders, for the most part, are not reintegrated, because in the United States, at least, one offense and you're removed from ministry forever. That's not the case in every other country, but that's the way it is here. But other places are moving toward that. If a man has raped a child once, he's never going to minister again. Some places will have some form of assistance at reintegration into society, depending on the offense and on the individual. But that's one area where our system has fallen down on its care and for the victims and on its care for the victimizers. And that's because of the humongous mistake of putting all your focus on the institution and its importance and its image. That's where the focus has been. And I've argued all along that the perpetrators are part of our community as well. And what would Christ do if he came down? Would he try to help them? He'd call them to account, but that doesn't mean that you make the situation worse, I think, by just abandoning them, but that's what happens. Just like the victims have been abandoned, because they're all an embarrassment. Victims and the victimizers are an embarrassment and they're a nuisance if all you're thinking about that's important is the power of your system.
My question is, you said that in our context, most victims are women. I'm just wondering where you heard that, or where to go to learn those facts. Thanks.
I'm sorry, I didn't get all your questions. In your context, most victims are women.
That's you mentioned that earlier.
Yes.
And so I'm just wondering where you heard that, or where you...
Well, I've gotten that from people, in your denomination that I've spoken with, that the issue is a lot of, women who are preyed upon, I guess, or assaulted, whatever word you want to use, by elders in the community or professors in the universities. If there's an instance of child sexual abuse going on, I'm not aware of it, but that doesn't mean it's not happening by any stretch. but the focus that I've picked up so far has been on that one issue. But it doesn't really matter. I mean, the point is, whether it's a 5-year-old kid or a 10-year-old kid or a 21-year-old student or a 35-year-old woman professor who's being victimized, it's a problem. And it's not less of a problem because the victims happen to be adult women than if they were children, because the harm is the harm. What it becomes problematic was how to deal with it. Did that answer your question at all? I mean, that's...
Well, I was just wanting to get the facts, and it sounds like it's mostly just kind of face-to-face conversation, no studies or anything.
I don't know if there's any statistics, if anyone's done a poll of we've got a lot of data in the Catholic Church and in a couple other denominations because we've had enough time to determine. And in the Roman Catholic Church, for example, 80% of the victims of sexual assault that we know about are young adolescent males. About 5% are children. So that's true pedophiles. But the whole issue of women in the Catholic Church being sexually preyed on is something that we don't know yet. I mean, it's there, but there's been no studies done, so there are no numbers. There's no statistics. So the information I have has been conversations, word of mouth. Which I have to say, I believe. You know, you don't have to have a sociological study to make something real. That's it. Thank you.
We could have gone on for a while. Thank you for your participation, active engagement, and the questions. We are. We have one more opportunity here on campus to hear Tom Doyle speak, and that's tomorrow right in this room, 11 a.m. for chapel gathering in the seminary community. It's open to everyone, to the broader community. The topic is Christian theology and sexual abuse. And I want to thank publicly some who helped to fund Tom's time with us, Wilmer Otto, the Everence Just Pax Fund in particular. Thank you very much for helping him to be here for 2 days. Again, staff from the Collins Center are here, and if you want to connect with them after this program, you'll linger around a bit, I imagine, now that I said that. But you probably would have anyway. Thank you for being here. And the expression stations will begin now. As soon as you can get to the campus center, for folks who are wanting to go for facilitated discussion, reflection corner, the candle lighting vigil, the what, so what, now what, community gathering, and it's one giant mural of words, or writing letters to EMU administration in particular, I think, but it could be writing letters to anyone at EMU. Go to the Campus Center Greeting Hall first, and then you'll find signs and folks to help you to go to where the stations are. I think that's where the hot chocolate and brownies are as well. Right here in Martin Chapel, we will have a hymn sing. Perry Blosser has back here has planned this hymn sing to move from lament to hope, planned in response to what we just experienced, and that may start at about 9:15. Thank you once again for being here.